Hello, everybody, and welcome to a slightly unusual edition of the Book Spider podcast. I say slightly unusual just because this was recorded in August of 2023, but a technical glitch caused the file to be inaccessible until just recently. So we have dug it out of storage, and this is out of the normal sequence of books that we cover. However, our sequence was just generally fucked for a while because we just had a real bad run of technical issues. It was very embarrassing. So this is from around a period where, you know, we had one episode about maybe once a month, and it was always, it was never the episode that we promised it would be because there'd been, you know, at least one failed podcast in the middle. I don't feel too bad about the issues with this episode, though, because it's an incredibly esoteric book that almost nobody has read, even though the three of us did all, to varying degrees, love it and had a great time reading and talking about it. With that being said, you may hear that the sound of my particular audio shifts a few times. I'm Hans, one of the three editors of Book Spider, or one of the three hosts of Book Spider, with Patrick Barney and Chris Malmberg. You'll hear the quality of my audio shift a couple times as it goes back and forth between contemporary recording and the lost recording from August, which was done in my parents' basement on my dad's computer, and turned out to be harder to extract the file from that than I thought. So all that being said, this is going to be an episode of, like I said, Book Spider, a particularly poorly, particularly sloppy one. Book Spider is a Book of the Week format podcast that dives further into intellectual smugness than any other books podcast in the podosphere. And this lost episode is on The Garden of Seven Twilights by Mikkel de Polol. Now, this is a novel that was originally published in Catalan in 1989 and was quite successful in Catalan, received a great deal of critical acclaim within the world of Catalan literature, but to my knowledge received no attention outside that community until the release of an English translation in 2023 on Dalkey Archive Press, who of course can always be counted on for such things. Now, personally, I would place Garden of Seven Twilights in the tradition of what's often referred to as the postmodern mega novel, which happens to be my own favorite type of novel, or at least a type that I feel a particular loyalty and allegiance to, even if that loyalty is only sometimes rewarded with actual reading pleasure. And I'll just take a little while to digress about that category. By postmodern mega novel, I mean a long and self-consciously messy literary novel which tests the reader's patience to its logically maximum extent with obscure narratives and formal experimentation and digression, not unlike this podcast intro. Now, the archetypal postmodern mega novel, and the one which cemented the idea in public and critical imagination, is, of course, Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Pynchon. The postmodern mega novel might extend its plot to just under 1,000 pages and end before the moment of resolution, as in David Foster Wallace's Infinite Jest or Roberto Bolaño's 2666. It might describe the action of a single day at such a length that another author could use the same space to describe an entire century, as in Adam Levin's The Instructions, or James Joyce's Ulysses, which is the first postmodern mega novel, despite the fact that Joyce is a modernist, right? Which I suppose makes this as good a time as any to note that examples of the postmodern mega novel both precede and antecede the actual postmodernist movement. The postmodern mega novel is almost always something produced by an author whose style is excellent at a line level, but it then presents such a great, undifferentiated glob of excellent style that most readers will choke on it, as in William Gass's The Tunnel, which is somehow both the most heart-shakingly beautiful and stultifyingly ugly book that I've ever read. Some other superstars of the category: Don DeLillo's Underworld is the most readable, critically appreciated postmodern mega novel. Joseph McElroy's Women and Men is the least readable postmodern mega novel, which really is a hell of a title to earn. And also of all the books that'll be mentioned in the segment, the only one that I was personally unable to finish. J.G. Ballard's The Atrocity Exhibition is the shortest postmodern mega novel. Some things that are sometimes thought of in that category, but that I personally think should be excluded from this discussion. William Volman's Europe Central is not a postmodern mega novel, despite being a mega-sized novel from a postmodern novelist, because Europe Central is too focused, it's too well-edited, it's too thematically coherent. Genre fiction rarely produces a postmodern mega novel because genre fiction does, of course, live by the imperative to be readable. But Samuel Delaney's Dahlgren is a postmodern mega novel from the sci-fi tradition. Haruki Murakami's 1Q84 is not a postmodern mega novel because it is exactly like every other Murakami novel. It's just longer and stupider. The postmodern mega novel, I think, should be qualitatively different from shorter work by the same author. So these are books that cut a notorious figure, right? Books with a maximum ratio of reputation to experience. That is to say, many people know the titles, very few have read them, especially because many of the people who have read them aren't entirely sure whether or not they did, in fact, read them, right? I read Gravity's Rainbow as a 19-year-old undergraduate, to the extent that I looked at all the words on the page, but I don't know that I really could have said afterward that I actually read the thing, right? And these, like Gravity's Rainbow, these are books which may be unreadable without a second book to explain the book to you, right? But you can read them without understanding them, but still impress people who haven't read them because nobody else understands them well enough to argue with you or to prove to you that you didn't read them. So the critical heyday of the postmodern mega novel, I think, began in 1974 when Gravity's Rainbow won the National Book Award. It ended in 2011 when Jonathan Franzen trashed The Recognitions and every other William Gaddis novel in a whiny little New Yorker piece, which coincided with Franzen's rise to the title of the literary world's premier retailer of overrated middlebrow pablum. So postmodern mega novels are now, for all intents and purposes, unpublishable, and kind of extinct as a genre for that reason. The most recent example I've encountered was Charlie Kaufman's Ant Kind, which would never have been published in a million years if he didn't have such a high profile as a screenwriter and director, and which will clog the shelves of used bookstores until the end of in-person retail. I should say that I personally loved Ant Kind. And in general, if it's not obvious, I do love this sort of book. And I've read everything that I've mentioned in this segment at least once, or almost once in the case of McElroy's Men and Women, which, as I noticed, I was, in fact, unable to finish and then loaned to someone whose child destroyed it. In some cases, I've read them twice or more. Why do I love these books? Well, you know, first of all, I admire their ambition, right? I just think it's cool that someone made something of that complexity and that scale. I admire the fact that it exists and it's out there, right? I find that level of commitment from an author inspiring in terms of the level of commitment it generates in me as a reader. And like I've said before on this podcast, there is something I appreciate about coming out the other end of a book and knowing there's more in there, right? If I read something and I feel afterward like I understood the whole plot and the theme and the basic metaphorical structure, that can be a satisfying experience, but it severs the relationship in a way, right? I feel less attached to the book if I feel like I am truly done with it. I like knowing that these books are always out there waiting for me to return to them, and there will always be more to be found when I do. Inevitably, I think there's also a certain amount of ego involved. You know, these are the Mount Everest of fiction, and if I can still climb these mountains, then it suggests I still have some, at least, of the focus and attention that I did in my youth, that not all of that has gone down the YouTube drain, right? Now, for the Franzens of the world, a book like The Recognitions conveys a sense of superiority and entitlement, right? The author feels entitled to have a reader who will follow him, and it inevitably has been a him, entitled to have a reader who will follow him through the labyrinth based on an ambiguous, at best, an ambiguous promise of pleasure. But, you know, to me, I think the Franzens of the world are the ones who feel entitled. They feel entitled not to put labor out as a reader, not to feel confusion, to know always what's happening and what it means, to have their particular level of attention pandered to. The thing is that however hard I have to work as a reader on something like Gravity's Rainbow or Infinite Jest or 2666 or The Recognitions, right, I know that the author had to work harder to write it, you know? And so I'm happy to bring as much as I can to the table. Anyway, all of this is a very extended, digressive set up to the fact that since 1989, the Catalan language has had its very own postmodern mega novel, which was not available in English until this year. And that novel, Garden of Seven Twilights by Miquel de Palol, that is what we're covering on today's podcast. So normally this would be the point in the podcast where I would offer, as you know, the host for the week, a summary of the events of the novel. But this is a, as you might imagine from the type of book that I'm lumping it into, this is an exceptionally difficult novel to summarize. There are a lot of different reasons for that. The core thing I think that makes it difficult is the structure of the novel, which is as a series of nested stories within stories, right? So the main frame of the novel is there's a narrator who is living in Spain in 2025 when a nuclear war breaks out. And he flees the nuclear war for reasons not really understood to him. He is taken to a shelter, an isolated shelter, which is, you know, beautiful and lavish and incredibly expensive. And there's an elite group of bankers and other sorts of, you know, quasi-government entities that are all hanging out there from the nuclear war, and he is allowed to shelter there. And over the course of 6 days, they begin telling each other stories, which initially seem disconnected, but become more and more connected as time goes on. And there's an effect that will happen where, you know, the narrator, the main narrator, the core narrator, will be listening to a story. And within the story, one of the characters will begin telling a story. And then eventually, once that technique has been established, then another character within that story will begin telling a story. And at one point, it goes 9 layers deep into that kind of nesting narrator technique. And, you know, jumps somewhat erratically between the different levels while it's buried 9 people deep. And the author was kind enough, Miquel de Palol was kind enough to provide a chart at the beginning of the book, which lays out the different stories and it kind of diagrams their relationship to each other. But without very, very careful attention, it's obviously still, as the novel goes on and as these different stories within stories kind of spiral out into further nested chaos, it becomes fairly hard to keep track of who's who and how these things all relate to each other. And I suppose it's debatable how much and to what extent the reader is expected to keep full track. That's probably one thing that we'll talk about. But that structural technique, I think, is both the kind of the hook of the novel, right? The thing that immediately at a glance makes it distinctive, and also the thing that makes reading challenging, and kind of the thing that is the most obvious as a point to talk about. Now, I can't begin to list all the stories, I can't begin to list all the characters, I can't really begin to list all the major events, partly because there are so many and partly because they're told from so many perspectives in such an erratic way. And to some extent, the novel doesn't really ever commit to answering its own core plot questions. But the rough, if I were to give a kind of rough aggregate of what all the stories add up to,
It's a story about a group of bankers and spies and criminals all competing to gain the use of something called the jewel, which rather than being a literal gemstone is sort of like a piece of code or a technology. The nature of it is never really defined. And rather than make half-hearted effort, I might kind of leave that for full discussion later on. But the nature of the jewel is such that the competition for it has in some way led to the current nuclear war that is enveloping the world. And the people at the table are telling stories in an attempt to, in some way, reveal to each other what the jewel is, what's happened to it, who has access to it, and what the nature of that artifact is. There are a few other questions that come up. There's a character named Omega, who's kind of a shadowy figure who controls all this. But I'm not sure that a meaningful synopsis can really be offered, at least in the space that we have here. I guess I'll go ahead and jump into the questions that I had planned, most of which I think can be talked to. I think most these questions can be discussed pretty effectively without actually, you know, having a clear breakdown of events. It's probably easier to do that with this than it might be with some other works. So the first question, and this is such an obvious one that I almost hesitate to jump right to it, but what do you make of the structure of the novel, the layers and layers of nested tellers and stories? What does that do thematically or structurally or just as a way of conveying information?
I didn't think about it until you pointed out the schematic at the beginning, and then also the device that the author uses to indicate when we're going up or down in the layers of narrative, which is especially helpful when you're jumping from like nine layers deep up to like the primary storyteller. So you can imagine the storyteller within the story of the story of this, you know, I don't even know how to say it. The someone in the party hiding out in that mansion from the nuclear war interrupts the story of a 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 story, and suddenly you find yourself at the very top for like two paragraphs that are maybe not even that inconsequential. Someone leaves the room and then you jump back down nine layers deep. But it seems like Paolola is actually trying to be pretty transparent about that with the schematic and the device. Like, and I think that that's interesting balanced against the real inscrutable complexity of the nested stories themselves. And, you know, Hans, you mentioned listing all of the characters. That is complicated by the fact that a couple times in the novel, we learn that the characters in one of the guest stories have had their names altered and are actually some of the people who are actually at the mansion hiding out from the nuclear war. So you follow along pages and pages and pages of what seems like a disconnected thing, and then you learn that so-and-so is actually so-and-so. And then also, you know, so much of the plot is inferred or sort of like built from like multiple points of view from on like similar events or the same event. And but no one there is sure whether anyone there actually witnessed it or whether the story is being conveyed, you know, third hand or fourth hand. And so there's this effect where everything that is described in these stories kind of breaks down, and it's kind of a crying of Lot 49-ish ending at the end, where like the primary narrator, the person whose POV we're in at the very beginning and at the end, is potentially going to learn. He's been led to believe that he might be the offspring of one of these families that has been involved in the kind of the competition for the jewel for generations. And but then he doesn't know which, and he doesn't even know if the jewel's real. And so it's this kind of ending where, like, all of the potential energy of all of these, you know, possibilities threatens to collapse into like a storyline, an answer, but it never does. And so I think going back to like something that you know didn't occur to me until you said it. It's interesting that Palal kind of does not like try to do anything artsy fartsy with these layers of stories. Like in terms of like the mechanic is really naked. Like it's really just like out there. And I think that that's an interesting thing to do. That's an interesting choice to really actually like be sort of friendly to the reader, because I, you know, some of these big postmodern novels can jump around POV and not really let you know when they're doing it, and then you have to kind of like catch up. But here, that's never actually the trick. And so that's interesting. I don't know how that, I think that that's a lot of what made me able to really enjoy the experience of jumping through stories, because I was not, even when you know, I wasn't really like into the particular vignette, I could feel, you know, I could navigate it to another vignette. It was, they were almost, you know, like, it's almost like a collection of short stories in a way. And so I did enjoy this novel. I'm not sure if I can answer thematically what it's doing other than really trying to make, you know, make us think about like, you know, the relationship of storytelling to like knowledge, and then like how impossible it is to know anything because of, you know, the fact, because of how we rely on stories to know things. And so that's interesting thematically, but I've read books that deal with that, you know, before, and I was more interested in just like the moment by moment experience of this novel. And I think that that was made possible by some of the choices that Palal made.
It's interesting to me that you know, you said, Chris, and you're kind of seconding a doubt that Hans mentioned in one of his questions about the theme of the novel. And it's interesting to me, Chris, that you know, you're saying it deals with like the impossibility of knowledge because all knowledge comes from stories. So and I agree, I think that is the major theme of this novel. So I'm wondering why, like, what is the, it seems pretty clear to me that that's what the novel is about thematically. And so what the reticence is to say that's the theme. And also, like, why wouldn't that be most interesting to you when it's done in an extremely unique way? Like, typically, I think that like epistemological nihilism of this sort is typically pretty boring to read about, like when that's the theme. But what I've thought was so awesome about this novel is that he doesn't do it by confusing the reader, where other writers will, like you say, like they'll jump a viewpoint and, you know, you'll be confused for a second. Or like, you know, if we're talking about other big novels that might, you know, share some, what'd you say? Share DNA, like, with this novel, something like the Against the Day, where it probably is sympathetic to the idea of epistemological nihilism, or maybe a moderate form of epistemological nihilism. But, you know, it investigates that nihilism in a completely different way. So the way that this novel kind of investigates it is not by confusing us. It's by, like, so there is a point in the novel where I think it's probably between Gertrudis and our main core narrator, where they're talking about how basically narrative, to get to the whole truth, you would have to have a narrative that is coextensive with reality, basically, where, you know, if you guys understand that idea. And so, like, I think what the novel is trying to do is point out, like, how hard that would actually be, and, like, to have all of these narratives that are trying to be coextensive with reality, it's an impossible task, right? So the problem isn't that narrative can't represent reality accurately. It's that it would have to be an exact copy of reality, right? So, is it? Oh, I think it is. Yeah, I think it is. I think it is. Like, there is a Borges story. So I think that's the way that this novel is using the Matryoshka layers, and the way that it's getting at its thematic effect, which is very different from novels that are thematically sympathetic, but that, like, kind of examine the same theme in a much different way.
I guess, and I'll say, I think you're right to call into question, like, my lack of being moved by that theme. I continue to be, like, to not feel moved by that theme alone. I think I am impressed by, like, what he's doing, you know, to accomplish that kind of, like, that stress, you know, on a reader of kind of, like, being given a picture of something and then questioning the nature of that thing. And a lot of authors, like, invite you to question the nature of that thing by kind of almost, like, mistreating you as a reader, I think you would say. And he's not doing that.
Right.
And
exactly.
I am really impressed with that. I think the reason that I poo-pooed the narrative, the theme, is that the thing that really carries it for me is what the theme sort of seems to lead to, which is a kind of affirming, like, sort of like self-identity, like self-perspective identity affirming, like, openness at the end, like a kind of the narrator is basically presented with almost, like, I don't know what you guys thought of this moment when he kind of, on day seven, everyone sort of told their stories. And he enters this room with Gertrudis, and everyone's just seating and staring at him. And there's one character there, the host, who is implied is Omega, but
Jamelian.
Jamelian, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I don't think he ever really. I don't know if he cops to it. He behaves like he is,
but he doesn't. But he doesn't actually cop to it.
Yeah, and then what follows is a kind of almost a ceremony feeling thing, like a ritual where the narrator, almost like everything in this story has been, you know, constructed around him, which is obviously true because, and it's the kind of the metafictional nature of the novel, but it's the themes of confusion, don't lead to a kind of existential despair. It's definitely an existential crisis at the end, but it's a crisis that leads to a kind of a forward momentum with the narrator, that and a kind of like a readiness to like to do something with his life. And I really liked that. I thought that was, I don't know that I've read that ending before. I was actually pretty moved by that. And I feel like, I don't know, I think that a lot of times that theme of it's impossible to understand the past leads to a kind of paralysis. Like I go back to, you know, Waterland by, you know, Graham Swift. That's about a kind of paralysis with history, like an immovable weight upon you. And I'm not going to think of any others, but I feel like that's a pretty common sort of springboard from that theme. And this one didn't do that for me. And so I really was moved by that.
I want to like, so to give an alternate reading of that ending,
that
maybe would hurt your feelings.
No, go for it.
So, well, only hurt your feelings because it's probably not as positive as you're saying it is. And at least I don't think it is. So, like, yeah, so it does seem like the narrator is impelled to action towards the end, which is different from, like, Waterland and other novels that deal with this theme, because, you know, much of the time epistemological nihilism just means like you can't do anything or think about anything profitably. But if we recall, the narrator is an idiot, right? Right? Like, I mean, I liked him well enough. I didn't think he was an idiot in an annoying way. But he's naive. He never seems to know what's going on. Whenever he makes a guess, he's always wrong. And like, I get this feeling at the end, like he approaches Gertrudis to express his feelings, and like she offers this total platitude. I've loved you since the first moment I saw you, right? Like, it's clearly, to me, it seems like it's more like hell as repetition. Like he's just going to keep going and searching and thinking, and, you know, he'll always be wrong because because of who he is. Right. Does that make sense? Like that alternate reading there?
I think that I definitely do pick up on the threads where he is like feckless,
right?
And I think that I don't know that they necessarily need to be like distinct readings. I think that
okay,
he's not, he has a kind of capable or not, he's acting at the end.
Fair
enough. And there was something in that. But no, I definitely am not going to argue that he's not a moron.
right. Sure.
I want to second Chris's point, because I was thinking just the same thing, that I think your two readings of the end don't seem to me to be mutually exclusive.
That makes sense. Sure. Like we could admit that he's frequently wrong, but also view it as positive that he chooses to act anyway. So that makes sense. Sure.
And I mean, ultimately still a model for action that he chooses to act, still a model for our action as readers that he chooses to kind of act and engage and live despite understanding that unknowability.
Well, the more I think about it, the more I like this ending. It's not as pessimistic, and I like pessimistic sometimes, but presented, like, just speaking from my own worldview, I would say if we are presented with unknowability, we have the choice to think, well, if either nothing matters because it can't be known, or things do matter whether we can know it or not, so we probably have to act like things matter. So I like that ending. I like that ending.
Right, right. I mean, I think you were talking earlier about our instinctive reactions to the theme of, what was it, epistemological nihilism. I'm a little bit behind the conversation in saying this, but I think that, like, I am not particular. Like, if you were to say to me, oh, the theme of this novel is epistemological nihilism and the fact that we can't really know anything because everything is determined by stories, that idea has turned into, not to get too political, but that idea feels to me like it's kind of the fat that's clogging the arteries of our political system, right? Or it's like the blood clot it's the blood clot that has kind of like lodged in the brain of modern politics and is giving it the aneurysm that will kill it, right? So I bristle at it, partly, you know, for those reasons. I mean, I think in the 80s, in the 70s and 80s, there was this idea that would be liberating, but at some point that liberation becomes quite dangerous. And I can appreciate aesthetically in this case how that's handled. It still doesn't taste good in a certain kind of, in a way, because, you know, with 30 or 40 years of hindsight. And I think too, it's interesting that, I don't know if there's anything to be gained here. It's at some point you get over this, but for a certain period of time, it was hard not to think about the verisimilitude of the verbal format, right? Where you have basically the idea that all of these quotes and all these nested tales are happening within stories that are presented verbally is absurd. And I was thinking, it's so absurd that it very quickly, you know, the absurdity becomes so obvious that there's no point in pointing it out, right? Even though occasionally the main narration will say something like, how could he remember that conversation so in such detail when it's something that he heard from somebody else, from somebody else, from somebody else, you know? Which is kind of, I don't know if you'd call that lampshading or exactly what, but I wonder, and maybe this is a fruitless question, is there a difference between, I think that most authors who tried to write something that worked roughly like this would do it with documents instead, right? Like the narrator would just be looking between a bunch of different, it would be like a found papers kind of format, right? Or it would be epistolary in a written sense. And it's interesting to me, I don't know if the choice to have it laid out in this verbal way, if that's partly just to honor things like the Decameron or the Canterbury Tales and kind of place it within that, or if there's something more to that when it would give it a bit more verisimilitude and probably work just as well in terms of creating the structure if it were more about, you know, finding a bunch of written accounts of this, like going through a database or something.
That's interesting because there's the author's foreword at the beginning.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I was gonna say it is found documents.
It doesn't negate the question you're asking, but still.
Well, it adds another layer of absurdity because the narrator has in fact had to copy down 1,000 pages worth of overheard stories.
Right, right, right.
Well, and the foreword at the beginning is so like dry and academic and awful,
but
like
also hilarious.
It's hilarious. And then the author's name, the academic author's name is, did you catch this? Mikhail de Palal Imaholi Makoli Dili. And when I first, Hans, this was not a kind beginning to this novel. I was not thrilled about the coming thousand pages of whatever the hell that foreword was. And then I really, really, really actually fell in love with it pretty quickly.
Some of these titles of these made up in the bibliography. Oh my God. Numeric Justifications in Occidental Post-Nuclear Thought, Poetry, Audition, and Respiratory Cognition. It's fucking hilarious. Oh my God.
It reminds me a bit, actually. I don't know if you guys have read this recently enough to remember it, but the introduction to The Handmaid's Tale.
I've never read The Handmaid's Tale.
Yeah, so The Handmaid's Tale, the novel The Handmaid's Tale, actually is presented as a, like, the main narration of The Handmaid's Tale is presented as a document that's been found that is being analyzed at an academic conference 150 years after the time of Gilead, when that whole system has collapsed.
Oh, so to give it some positivity, or make it a little optimistic, maybe?
Well, it does imply optimism for sure, yeah, because, I mean, it suggests, in fact, that the dystopia of that novel has long, long, you know, that it had a very short lifespan, and that the text as it exists is actually something being interpreted by, you know, people who've moved beyond that, and who almost kind of regard it as a historical curio in a way. It's almost like if you imagine a serious version of this introduction, it's that. It's very, very similar. I think they might even have come out in the same year, 89. I might be misremembering it, but they're within a few years of each other. I'm sure it's just a coincidence, but it, like, this is a goofy version of the frame for The Handmaid's Tale. Which, to some extent, I mean, I'm whipping out, you know, trivia knowledge as a way of getting around my lack of meaningful insight here, but...
Well, I mean, I like this intro. I think that it adds to the theme, like, because there's this implication in the foreword here that we would have to read the core narrator's story, like the whole thing is just fiction, and there are fictional texts in the biography that are like the myth of the Garden of Seven Twilights. So there's this clear in this future of the year 3000, it seems like, or thereabouts, it seems like there is this academic discussion on whether or not this document, the Garden of Seven Twilights, is history or fiction, right? So that adds to the whole, like, you can't know jack shit idea. But also, if you notice in the, so I'll just read from towards the end of the author's foreword. This is the last paragraph. To compose the present version, we have relied on the codex NMJHHAX-40-BNB in New Jerusalem, which is in a significantly better state than Browska's original reproduced in Sydney. We have supplemented this with this VUZN-6A from Nakanti for the three missing stories from the second part, and with the Codex 40-MPH, da 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 da. So you got this list of codexes, and this is kind of mirrored at the end of the novel in the core narrator's vision of the future. Let me get to it.
Yes. I highlighted that as well, I think.
And let me find it real quick. I'm scrolling through. We can edit this part out. Oh yeah. So it's like, this is the core narrator. Here's what a ready-to-consume conversation template might look like. Convivium J-504-B setting M-5. Did you see the OR-03 orgasmatron I bought? Yeah, super orgasmic. How much was it? I busted my fucking ass to get one. No luck, though. It cost 14.80 in Neo dollars. Super dope, yeah. It's right in line with the BGCS XUIUIU1 the JPIL 784222. Apostrophe standard. I got three more at Hyper-Q line thanks to a 4Q-6A P-Brain credit. I'm dying to fucking know. Give me the specs. Two FOs, fucking orgasms per minute, or seven CMOs, clit massage orgasms, guaranteed every 3 minutes, with a minimum of 800 calories burned and 9,575 neuros per use. So, like, it seems like there's something, like, I know that the context of the foreword and the context of this, like, vision are a little different, but still they mirror each other strikingly, which is, so what does it say that the foreword says that this whole thing is probably fiction? But then at the end, the core narrator has a vision of the future that is very similar to what's going on in the foreword. I don't know if there's anything to say about that, but it seems like the foreword is, it's not just some bullshit. Like there was real time and thought that went into that, it seems like.
Just in terms of reading experience, how much did you guys feel like you actually pieced the events together as you were going? I mean, did you feel like you were tracking how all the stories were fitting together to the extent that they were, or was it really more kind of enjoying moments in the journey, enjoying kind of, because there are lots of isolated bits here that are very amusing or very entertaining or briefly kind of briefly suspenseful just by themselves, absent the larger context, right? And I mean, maybe inevitably, like, my memory of the novel is in some way more dominated by a lot of those small moments, those more kind of contextless things, than it is by the larger schema or the way that the pieces fit together. If I were to, I was, right before the podcast started, I was trying to make a list of some of my favorite vignettes and stories. The first one that came to mind was the story of the man who is essentially being molested by the ghost of his dead wife.
Oh yeah. That's good.
His dead wife is coming to him and molesting him, and he says, well, we never had sex that much when we were alive. And she says, well, actually, as a ghost, I can experience all time forms. And he begins having more and more memories of having sex with his wife when she was alive. He's essentially being, you know, molested through all time by a ghost.
That was pretty awesome.
And that's a hilarious little vignette, and it's one of the very few things that is, to my knowledge, never fit into the larger story, right? It truly is freestanding. And that's my favorite thing. And so, I don't know, I was just wondering what your guys' experience was between, what your ratio was between enjoying the kind of finer details of the things as they went by versus actually having that. I mean, it seems like much of the time the characters are having flashes of recognition that, oh, this adds up to this, that maybe the reader is not so much sharing. I was wondering how that felt for you.
There was a I don't remember the storyteller, maybe it was Carter, talking about a political intrigue overseas where one spy is, I actually kind of remembered the transition into from kind of being really bored, because some of these vignettes I did find just straight up boring. And this one started out boring, and then the construction of the suspenseful, like, situation was really actually kind of interesting, where basically a double agent was suspected by the group that he was spying on of being a double agent. And the order to kill him had been sort of like, basically he had to die in order to preserve his, you know, embedded, you know, like not have his cover blown. So he had to be killed to not have his cover blown and not have the work undone, which I thought was like a pretty interesting, like, construction. But what really got me, and I might actually be conflating one story with another, which is, you know, pretty much what makes this novel interesting. But I'm pretty sure this is the narrator that has like a whole internal council of weird, there's a czar of the seven pennies or whatever. And do you guys remember this guy? He in the middle of basically like engaging in these political intrigues, he'll turn to his inner sort of like dialogue. And he explains it, and it's like these different figures in his head debating what he should do. And there are pages devoted to this, like the internal landscape of this person's like devil on one shoulder, angel on another, but like way more complicated and involving like just like titles of hierophants and kings and lords that are that don't matter. Because they're figments in this guy's imagination. This wasn't my favorite story, but when you asked about vignettes that stuck out, like there was something just so audacious about like wasting my time on these fucking imagined people. I don't know. It just was. It actually kind of made me. It actually brought a little bit of joy, even as it frustrated me.
I really liked Casanova's story of the repeated day. I thought that was awesome. Maybe because when I was a kid, I saw this movie 1201, which has that exact, that kind of idea where one character is repeating a day and it happens over and over. I really liked the suicide cult story. I think that, according to the Tree of Tales I'm looking at, that's a sub-story of Kolinsky and is told by the Superman Peter Schweinstein, or maybe is just the story of... It's not told by because he's dead. But, yeah, I liked that one. Personally, I actually loved the main story. And did feel that, I'm not saying that, I followed every bit of it, but I definitely enjoyed, all these different connections and of the main story. I really liked the part of it where the four women, one of whom is Louisa Crows, and one of whom is... the core narrator's mother, they're all named differently. And so it's like Louisa is Victoria and she's married to not Wrong Call. That's somebody else. I forget Louisa is married to Robert Cullum, but in the story she's named Victoria. And she's married to Robert Cullum, but whatever his other name is, I think it starts with an R, but I forget. And then, but she falls in love with someone else who takes a pill to look like her husband, which I think is super cool. I think that's pretty fantastic. And I thought it had awesome, implications for the core narrators watching, the core narrator has a crush on Gertrudis, but he's carrying on a relationship with Amelia. And then he sees this crazy snuff film that Amelia makes, which the description of it physically made me gag. I don't think I've ever had a physical description actually make me gag. But it was also darkly humorous the way the like the video describes the men roaring as they come. Like, I thought that was hilarious. And disgusting.
But then he is kind of believing that Amelia's maybe his sister.
Yeah. And he likes that.
He likes that.
Oh my God. But
it's so fucking funny.
There were so many funny moments. But I guess to answer your overall question, Hans, like, I think I enjoyed the main stories as much as I enjoyed the vignettes. Like, if we're making a distinction between those two.
Well, I mean, it sounds like, the distinction between the two is somewhat arbitrary, right? I think it's less a question of each section being put into one or the other and more a question of how you received them as a reader. Because almost everything is both a vignette and something that fits into the larger plot. But, I mean, you were able to integrate the experience of both reading them as fragments and reading them as pieces of a larger interlock, which is the goal, I suppose. So that's great. Last question, I think. I had a couple other things written out, but we've touched on most of what I had in mind just kind of organically. But the last thing I was just wondering about, and this is going to combine, I think, two threads that I was thinking about. Being written in 2025, how well do you, or being written in 1989 about 2025, how much do you think that it's interesting as a text that is in any way kind of prophetic about how the next, you know, 40 years following that would go? And then secondarily, you know, what has kind of aged well in that portrait of our world, and what themes is it, what is it saying about the world? What does it have any theme? I mean, obviously there's the theme, of course, like we've talked about, of epistemological nihilism, but is there any other kind of statement that makes about money, power, wealth?
I really liked, and I think this really aged well, was this idea of a bunch of rich socialites and bankers and heirs to bank fortunes surviving the apocalypse in this remote location. And they're all a bunch of, you know, they're all a bunch of selfish kind of horrible people. And I would think that these are the kinds of people who are going to survive the apocalypse, right? If there is one, you know, these are the people who are going to have the money to move at a moment's notice and have a safe place already prepared for them. So I thought that aged pretty well, especially as fears of climate change have only gotten worse and worse and worse.
This is kind of maybe more like a coincidental detail than something you could really ascribe to, you know, clever observation or anything like that. But it's funny that there is a very sophisticated warship called the Google,
yeah,
whose supercomputer achieves sentience.
Yeah, that.
Yeah.
Which is just a funny coincidence because, you know, a guy who worked on some AI at Google a couple years ago said that it had achieved sentience, right? So very strange overlap there with reality.
I have this is a little bit long, but it's a quote pulled from, I think, the very end. He's basically in that kind of that epistemological crisis. He's in the midst of it. I imagined the future. The man who had definitely lost his primordial inner silence would soon no longer be able to bear any other. First, he would need music, then continuous noise. The aggression would harden the organ, then, like a drug, he'd have to turn up the volume more and more. I imagined the backs of my eyes. Would the day eventually come when man had become unable even to feed his own dumb and incessant inner chatter, so reviled by the Hindus? Will it have to be injected from without? This was the person who would survive the wars to come, an amnesiac with regard to inner dialogue, and consequently unsuited to thought and reflection. He wouldn't arrive at a silence akin to the yogis, one of ecstasy, but to the uselessness of any coherent discourse. Without an auto-dialogical synthesizer, his inner incontinence will be an uninterrupted neuralgic gesticulation, like the frying of a bad transistor. Advertising will no longer operate by suggestion, disguised depression, or anything else, not even by simple reminders. It will simply be orders issued according to a universe-guided program, activities, conversations, desires created, and illusorily satisfied. So I think he did a pretty good fucking job.
He really did.
Yeah.
I read that line or those series of lines numerous times. I thought that was pretty fucking badass. Neuralgic gesticulation. Oh man. Fucking good book. I loved it, as I said.
I like it more and more the more we talk about it. It's so big and just diaphanous, and like I'm realizing with a kid that there's actually a kind of a way to like, there's a way that like big, huge things are like, they're kind of dipping in and out of them is almost a better fit with a kid than like something like a movie. Like I can't watch a movie right now to save my life. Hans, you told me to basically call you after I finished Infinity Pool. I have not finished that fucking movie. Like I've like made it a few minutes at a time. And for whatever reason, I found this big ass novel, something that I could just sort of pick up and fall into. And I think that probably like for you know, sometimes short periods of time, sometimes longer. But I think that I don't know, it's like a different stage of my life where like a book like this, you know, works. But I wonder, like, it's crazy that this book had an English translation and is coming out now, because I think it's just such a huge book. I can't imagine the general populace, you know, signing on for this experience that's so stretched
out.
Well,
and it came out on Dalkey Archive Press, who are pretty much, like, the whole idea of their thing is to basically keep esoteric fiction in print and distribute esoteric fiction. And they might bristle at that simplification, but that's Dalkey Archive Press. They rescue esoteric fiction from being out of print, and they try to, get some kind of a space for esoteric fiction from all over the world that might not be familiar to the English readership. And that's not, I mean, Penguin publishes a certain amount of esoteric stuff. I don't mean to slag Penguin, right? But this is not something that, even in 1989, it would have had a hard time finding a stateside audience or an English-speaking audience. To some extent, I suppose, like, the fact that it has become so legendary in its native language is, which apparently it has from the little bit that I've read about it, it seems very well regarded in Catalan letters. The fact that it had the time to kind of achieve that status becomes a bit more of an argument for it in a certain audience, myself included. But yeah, I don't think anybody had the idea that this would break through to a mainstream crowd or even attract the kind of attention that something like Infinite Jest or 2666 would have 10 or 20 or 30 years ago.
All right, everyone. Thank you for listening to our discussion of The Garden of Seven Twilights by Mikhail de Polol. I have omitted the part of the show where we would normally talk about the next thing that we're covering because this particular episode was posted somewhat out of order of when it was recorded because of a technical glitch. It is, of course, resolved now, but we'll be back in a couple weeks with an episode that fits into our normal schedule. Hope everybody has a good night.